I'm Goldie Sayers, Olympic javelin medalist, and welcome back to the EIS Insider, the podcast from the English Institute of Sport that lifts the lid on the science behind peak performance. So far this series, we've focused on what goes into making a champion, from nutrition to cardio, psychology to lifestyle. But what people see on TV is only part of an individual's journey and experience. When preparing for a major championships, behind the scenes, athletes, support staff and coaches will be testing out new ways of doing things to find out what works and how to improve. And part of testing out what works is also finding out what doesn't. Things not going right or failing is actually a surprisingly common part of the performance journey. So should we all talk more about it? And what life lessons can elite sport teach us about failure? I'm incredibly grateful to be sitting here as an Olympic medalist, but I would say that a large part of my career, like Winston Churchill said, was going from failure to failure without any loss of enthusiasm. So helping me to gain some perspective on the times when I and many other athletes have been disappointed, I'm joined by two big names from the English Institute of Sport, Kevin Currell, Director of Performance Support and Science. Hi, Kevin.
Hi, Goldie.
And Nigel Walker. Now, Nigel is a former national director of the EIS who's recently moved into a new role with Welsh Rugby. Welcome, Nigel.
Hi, Goldie.
So, Kevin, Director of Performance Support and Science, that's a very fancy job title. What does your role at the EIS involve?
I've split it down to three bits, really, the three bits of the job title. So, director means I'm part of the senior leadership team of the EIS and help it deliver its strategies. Performance support, that's about supporting those performance support teams led by our heads of performance support in all the sports across Olympic and Paralympic sports. Then science is about ensuring we deliver really good science services with really good standards and develop the practitioners to deliver those to the athletes and coaches they work with.
So a fairly hefty remit there.
It's a big remit, but fortunately there's a lot of good people who work with me to deliver that remit.
Great. And Nigel, you're one of those very unusual individuals in that you have competed at the very highest level in more than one sport. So you were indeed an Olympian from the 1984 Olympic Games in the 110 metre hurdles, but you also are an ex-Welsh rugby player earning 17 caps for Wales. But not only that, I will go on, you have worked outside of sport as well, not least for the BBC and also within sport, both at the EIS, and you're also about to move to a new role in Welsh rugby. So you've clearly got used to changing and challenging yourselves and potentially somebody who likes taking risks. Can you tell us a bit about your career, both in and outside of sport, and has it gone as you would expect it to?
Wow, what an introduction.
Really
exciting. You have done your homework. I feel as if I'm being stalked. I started off, like most people, in school. And I love sport. I played loads of sports. I played basketball. I played football. I played rugby. I played baseball. I was just a sport nut. And my parents quite often grabbed me by the collar and said, listen, son, you need to do a bit of schoolwork. So I sort of got the balance right, but there was sort of a leaning towards sport. And as I got to sort of 14, 15, 16, two sports, you could say I excelled at. I was a little bit better than the others. And they were athletics and rugby. And I did both of those sports until I got to about the age of 18. And I had to make a choice. And I chose athletics because athletic selection is so much more objective than rugby selection. And that's what it came down to. So I had my athletics career. I was fortunate I trained with people like Colin Jackson, who is right at the top end. And that gave me a really good grounding because Colin left no stone unturned. And then when I got to about 29, my athletics career had gone as far as it could do. And I started playing rugby and I was very fortunate. You said I'm a risk taker. My family would be laughing. I am the most cautious man in the world. But I do like a challenge, if that's not a contradiction. And that's led me on the path that I've been on.
And obviously, within your sporting career, you will have had successes and failures. Looking back at it, were there any failures, in inverted commas, that ended up being a positive?
Loads. Let me pick out a few. unlike Colin Jackson, I lost more races than I won. So there was plenty of failure. But probably the biggest one, and the one that had the biggest impact, I went to the Olympic Games in 1984 as a 20-year-old. And to be perfectly honest, my selection was a bit of a surprise. And I got there, and instead of thinking, right, reevaluating what did the success look like for me now, I was still thinking, I'm at the Olympics. And I fell in the semi-final. And even then I thought, well, look, you're 20. You'll be back in 4 years' time. 4 years' time in Seoul, I was injured. And in 1992, the Barcelona Olympics, Colin finished ahead of me, John Ridgen finished ahead of me, Tony Jarrett finished ahead of me. It was just a time of excellence within sprint hurdling. And a couple of lessons. First of all, you can live in the moment, but always project forward. And if you do better than you think you should have done, reevaluate and set higher targets. And the second one is, don't take anything for granted. Because I thought I'd be an Olympian in 1988, injured, 1992, didn't happen. They say that both success and failure leaves clues, and it's absolutely right. I won't say any more than that, but it's absolutely right.
We'll definitely be coming back to that. But Kevin, why do you think so many people are kind of afraid of failure and have that level of fear of failure? And why do you think that people don't talk about failing more often?
Oh, so it's a great question. I think in sport, we often, well, I'm sat here talking to two Olympians, like you're put on a pedestal, I think, as these sort of superhumans. And you are in one way, but you're still just human as well. And therefore, it's really hard to be vulnerable to show that failure. And I think watching the sort of Tokyo Olympics and Paralympics, some of the conversations with athletes post their performances, particularly those who didn't get a medal, it felt different for me as well, listening to that. People were talking about it was success for them. And I think there's an element of feeling safe to be vulnerable to talk about failure, whether it be with your close team who you're with as an athlete, go on that journey with you, or sort of with the wider public. But the reality is most athletes fail, don't they? There are three people who stand on the podium. At some point, 100 odd years ago, somebody decided top three was important, and we've sort of followed on with that. And I was listening to some golfers the other day, and so even the great golfers spend most of the time losing and not winning.
Yeah.
So sort of failure is actually quite, it's the norm, isn't it, in reality? So I don't quite know why we don't talk about it, but I think there's definitely something in that's really powerful about talking about it and allowing that vulnerability of whether it be the athletes, coaches, support staff or anyone around that to go through that failure process.
Yeah, and I think a big part of sport is almost being a professional problem solver, and that's obviously where you're doing a lot of your work, and that must involve a lot of testing and potentially failing on a day-to-day basis behind the scenes in order to kind of understand what drives that athlete to higher performances. And would you think that's a fairly apt description of what you guys do?
Oh, 100%. I mean, at the end of the day, that, you know, we're underpinned by science and evidence base, and people often think science is a yes, no. If it's science, it must be factual. The reality of that is far from it. Science is a process where you have a hypothesis, you then do something to test it, you then look at the results, you analyze them. You've either proven your hypothesis or you haven't, but inevitably you will develop more. And then you go through that process again and you iterate it. It does make me laugh when you see people assume science knows everything, and it doesn't, because it's a process that is about failure almost, and being willing to do that.
Yeah, it's fascinating. I think science to a point, and then there becomes a bit of an artistic element to it later on in the performance piece.
Hugely. And I think particularly that when you're working with an individual athlete, so quite often that process with science, if you're doing pure research, you're doing that on tens, hundreds, thousands, tens of thousands of people to get the best chance of that. An athlete is an N of one. You know, Goldie, are different to another javelin thrower in your day. So you're working with you as an individual. It's still the same process behind that. What are you trying to achieve? How do I think I can help? Let's test it in a way that works for you. And let's reassess it. But that's also quite similar to the coaching process.
Yeah.
In a way as well. So the sort of a well-honed process that works there in many different ways.
Yeah, and ultimately a bit of trial and error. And Nigel, do you think failure can help athletes?
Yes. It's not very comfortable when it happens. And the bigger the competition or tournament, the more uncomfortable it is. And I guess the more experience the athlete or the team has, the worse that feeling can be. But often, failure makes you a better human being, and it also increases your chances of being successful in the future if you treat failure in the right way. And you have to assess what failure is, first of all. That's a big question in itself. So if I ran in the European Indoor Championships, which I did, and I got a bronze medal, that was success for me. To use Colin Jackson again, if Colin had anything less than gold, that was failure for him. So Kev has just talked about science. Yes, it is a process. And it's the person who's applying that process and what they get out of it. But you can apply the process in exactly the same way and get different results if you put in one athlete, athlete A and athlete B. And that's where experience comes in. And just like individual scientists use experience, so an organization like the EIS will use this experience. And often the one physiotherapist treating Goldie Sayers, if I could use you as an example, not just using what they've learned, but using what the organization has learned through the physiotherapist who's immediately before them and the physiotherapist who was before that. And that's what the EIS has been built on. So that's the value of an institute. And the central funding of that institute is one of the reasons why Team GB and Paralympics GB have been able to punch above their weight for the last 20 years.
Absolutely. Well said, Nigel. The team behind the team, absolutely. But if we go back to disappointment and perhaps not performing how athletes would like to, we often hear athletes talk about, you know, the losses hurt. And as you said, you know, certain losses of yours or whatever may have stayed with you for quite a long time. Do you remember those times when you, in inverted commas, failed more vividly than when you won? Or do you think about success and failure now very differently?
I think that's an individual thing, and it's often personality driven, in my view. I tended to focus on the negative things, and I was told off. It hurts. And I can remember, twice I'm going to mention this, falling in the Olympic Games. I'm going to be in tears in a moment. Crikey, it took me months, if not years, to get over that. And in those days, you didn't have mobile phones, there I say it. And I had to phone my mum. It took me 2 days to phone her because I knew she'd be worried. It took me 2 days to phone her just to be able to have a conversation with her from Los Angeles. So I did feel things. If I made a mistake in a rugby game, and thankfully I didn't make too many, which cost the team, everybody makes mistakes that cost the team big matches, I just wouldn't be able to face the support and everything else. That's the way I beat myself up. And lots of athletes do it. But you need to get to a position where you can beat yourself up, in inverted commas, but recover from it, learn from it, and try not to repeat the same mistakes. And that is a real skill. And some people do it better than others. But the really great champions, they have learned from their mistakes, learned from those early mistakes, and they very rarely repeat them again, which is why they become repeat winners.
So do you think that the champions, effectively, they get over their disappointments quicker? Or what do you think sets them apart to people who perhaps don't?
Not necessarily more quickly, but they learn from them. And those lessons, once they're learned, they're ingrained, and they tend not to make the same mistake again. You talk to any sports person and say, "Oh, I can't remember the last time I lost," or "I can't remember how bad that was," they're fibbing. Human beings are human beings. And obviously, some people rebound quicker than others. I'm not suggesting everybody's the same. But when people say, "Oh, I scored that own goal, didn't mean anything to me," rubbish. Of course it means something to them.
And Nigel, you've got that kind of interesting experience of having won and lost in an individual sport, but also in a team sport. Is there a difference between failing, say, on your own and failing as part of a team? What are the differences, if there are any?
Let me make it simple for you. I felt rubbish when I fell in the Olympics. I felt rubbish when we lost in the Heineken European Cup final. It's the same. The slight difference is, if you're in an individual sport, you can look in the mirror and say, "Well, actually, I'm the one who put in all the work." if I can get over it, everybody else can get over it. It's not quite the same in a team sport if you've dropped a potential try-scoring pass, or if you scored an own goal, or if you've done something which let your teammates down. It's a slightly different feeling, but failure is failure and it hurts.
We've kind of touched on it a little bit, but what would you both say are the key differences between the how the champions recover from disappointment compared to the other athletes who perhaps don't quite get to the same level? And what do they do differently, would you say?
The key is learning from whatever the success or failure is and adapting to that. And that sounds really easy to say, but that's actually really hard to do, whether you're an elite athlete or Joe Bloggs. I think I see those great athletes, they go back to what the process was. In some ways, the outcome is not in your control, is it? If you can throw your PB and three other people throw further, then so be it. So I think that's that sort of dispassionate. Did you execute the performance and the process that you did for that? I think it's a willingness to ask tough questions, not to feel comfortable, which kind of comes back to what I said at the beginning about safety, to feel vulnerable, both yourself and the people around you, to really do that. Psychological safety is absolutely key. But I think the key is they learn from it and they adapt from it. They don't just do the same thing again. And we have seen that, haven't we? In many sports, in many walks of life, where that failure, if you like, repeats itself. Whereas the best athletes don't let it repeat, because they've come back to the process, they've learned from it, and then they've implemented that learning.
And what about those athletes who perhaps don't learn from failure? I mean, an example might be the England football team and penalties, and being a fairly obvious example of, we don't tend to learn from our failures in those circumstances that often. What would you say to those athletes who aren't learning from failures that they might be having? Penalties might not be the best example, but
well, it's so close to not being the best example. The fractions away, isn't it? In the summer, the last World Cup, they won a penalty shootout under intense pressure, and it probably shows how hard it is at the top end of sport to learn from some of those things. It seems really obvious, doesn't it? Sort out penalties for England football and it will all be fine. And I'm sure they've worked incredibly hard over the last 4 or 5 years. In fact, I know they have to do with that. And it still didn't quite work on the day. But you know what? They inspired a nation for 4 or 5 weeks, didn't they? It was incredible. Many people falling in love with football again. So while they will see failure, maybe they did something else that was beyond winning a football match.
So Nigel, how do you now assess success, I guess, individually or within a kind of sports organisation? And I guess, why is it so important to view success outside of finishing in medal positions? Because obviously not every athlete that comes through the EIS and other organisations are going to finish in a medal position.
Yeah, I guess you have to do the planning, whether you're an individual athlete, whether you're performing in a team, whether you're an organisation like the EIS, you do the planning. As far as the EIS is concerned, we do our planning. We submit that plan to UK Sport. UK Sport give us a sum of money to carry out that plan or elements of that plan. You have to know what success and failure looks like. And that's what we've been talking about. What does it look like for the EIS? What will success look like? And at the end of any given period, you then have to look back and say, did we hit that target? Did we hit that target? Did we hit that target? For an athlete, did I run this fast? Did I throw that fast? Did I jump this far? How often did I do it? Was it what I said I would do? If the answer is yes, big tick. How can I get to the next level? That's what an athlete will do. That's what this organisation will do. How can I get to the next level? If the answer is no, well, why not? And then there has to be an honest conversation. And this is the difficulty. And Kev's talked about vulnerability. When you're an athlete, it's very difficult sometimes to say, I wasn't good enough. I know I didn't like saying that when I was an athlete, when I was a rugby player, I wasn't good enough. But being honest with yourself is the start. Why wasn't I good enough? I went out too often. I didn't train hard enough. I didn't do enough of these sessions, but I didn't really like whatever it is. How am I going to correct that? Put a plan in place to correct it, have a way of monitoring that plan and tweaking, nipping and tucking to make sure that you're on target. And it's exactly the same with an organization.
So what practical tips can people learn from sport that they can take back into everyday life about kind of performance or failure? I'm thinking about, you know, if somebody's dream is to win their pub football league, for example, or get a promotion at work, what tips can you give people that they can apply to other areas of life in order to perhaps get a bit better at whatever it is that they want to achieve?
So it's what do I want to achieve? Is that realistic? What is it going to take for me to achieve that? Am I prepared to pay the price? I remember meeting Colin Jackson when he was about 16 or 17. He came to my parents. I was still living with my parents. He came into the living room and I introduced him to my mum. And mum said, "Oh, hi, Colin. Pleased to meet you. What do you want to do?" He didn't say, "I want to run for Cardiff" or "I want to run for Wales." He said, "I want to be Olympic champion." That's what he said sitting in my living room. I thought, flipping it. And he said it as if he meant it. And he said it as if he meant it because he did mean it. He wanted to become, he's only 17, 16, 17. He wanted to be Olympic champion. And that's the way he lived his life. And you know him. That's the way he lived his life. And he didn't become Olympic champion. He only got an Olympic silver when he was 20. But he was double world champion outdoors, fastest man on this earth, indoors and out, 4 European titles, 2 Commonwealth titles, loads of European indoor titles. He was pretty successful. But he meant it. He had that big, hairy, audacious goal, and he was prepared to do what it took in order to make that a reality. Carl Lewis used to always talk about that's the most important element. Am I prepared to pay the price? Am I prepared to put in the hours? Am I prepared to do the work? Am I prepared to refine my skills? Am I prepared to? Am I prepared to? Am I prepared to? And if the answer is yes to all of the above, well, you're more than halfway to achieving it.
Nice. And Kev, anything, any nuggets from the performance world?
I can't quite beat that, but I think if you do that and then you add on top that plan, do review, or in science terms, have a hypothesis, test it and analyse it, that becomes the engine, I think, to allow you to navigate your what will inevitably be a rocky journey to achieving something big, as Nigel said. But I think it does start with having that big goal, whatever it may be. It might be the Olympics, or it might be running park, just running 5K in parkrun on Saturday. Like, it's all the same.
It's interesting, isn't it? It's very easy to get carried away with Olympians and Paralympians and world records and Olympic golds and all the rest of it. But if somebody's sitting there on their sofa listening to this, or walking to work listening to this or whatever, and they think, "Oh, I need something in my life," I guess the first thing is creating time to think about what you need in your life. And it could be, right, this weekend I'm going to schedule an hour between 3 and 4 on Sunday, between 1 and 2 on Saturday, and I'm going to think about what I want to do. I know what I want to do, but I'm going to plan what I want to do. And it's finding the time to think. And in this modern world of ours, we go from one thing to another at 90 miles an hour, and we very rarely, most of us, have the time to stop and think. But often that's the most valuable training time, if I can call it that, of all. Sitting down and thinking, and just having time where you're not going to be disturbed by anything else, where you can really think it through, and then you're on the way to achieving whatever you want to achieve.
And we've seen more conversations about failure being part of growth in society. And there's a great podcast from Elizabeth Day called How to Fail. How important do you think these kind of conversations are, Nigel?
Well, I think to Kev's point that people showing their vulnerable side and being prepared to talk about things which are could be described as failures, or things that they think are weaknesses in their armory, people were reluctant to talk about them 20, 30 years ago. People are much more likely to talk about them now. I think it can help the individual, but it can also help tens of thousands of people in society who are grappling with the same things or similar things. And that's why an open conversation, nobody's asking anybody to go out there and lay bare their soul. That's not what we're asking about. But when people are struggling, there's nothing wrong with saying, "I'm struggling with this." And once you've admitted you're struggling with something, you're far more likely to find the solution to that problem, or at least find a way of living with that situation, if not rectifying it completely. And I think that's important. And we've seen stories over the years of people who have failed very publicly, and then they have redeemed themselves 2 years later, 4 years later, 6 years later. And you can see certainly the British public, which I can talk about, actually rejoicing in that person going from so-called failure to success. And that's why it's important.
And I guess sport being a microcosm for life, which is why we all love it so much. Thank you both so much for joining us on the podcast. And good luck, Nigel, in Welsh rugby. We shall look forward to seeing how you get on in the coming weeks, months and years.
Thank you.
Wasn't that great to hear from Nigel and Kevin? I think they shared some valuable lessons we can all take away. If you want to chat more about this topic, you can get in touch with us on social media at EIS2Win. Or why not send us a message to let us know where you're listening to us, just like Wilts Hammers did, who tells us that he's enjoying our show because he finds it really interesting to understand the detail and preparation that goes into elite sport. Well, stay tuned, because coming up on the EIS Insider, we're crunching numbers, as our next episode is all about stats. But can sport really be reduced to just data? We'll find out more next week on the EIS Insider. In the meantime, thanks for listening, and we'll catch up soon.